A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online so any small business can make a change. We need a new generation of thinking. Your way of thinking. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
This is an ode to the glass noodle. You may be glass only in name, but our love for you is crystal clear in every Bibigo Korean dumpling. Your tantalizing texture tickles the taste buds, and while you are see-through, the world can't help but see you. The glass noodle, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every plump and juicy Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hey, Garnett, how's it going?
Going well. How about you over there in Boston?
Things are good. It's a beautiful day today. But man, it's been months since we talked in this forum, and a lot since, think back to what, late February, early March, when we did our last episode of the second season. What has changed between now and today, between then and today?
Might be easier to talk about the things that haven't changed.
Haven't.
Because it seems like the world is either on fire or topsy-turvy or whatever metaphor you want to use. But a lot has changed, right?
Yeah.
So we're gonna be hitting on some of those topics today, actually, I think.
Yeah. Boy, with everything going on in the world, I think we have the perfect first guest for the first episode of the new season, Frederick Gross, principal at Storm Ventures and co-founder and board member at Black VC. Frederick, welcome to the iPod.
Hey there. It's an absolute pleasure to be here today and to kick off a new season.
Yeah.
And excited to chat about a number of these issues that are certainly creating an interesting business environment for tech companies and startups alike.
To say the least. Yeah. Can you share your background, Frederick?
Yeah. No, happy to. So, as you mentioned, you know, I'm a principal today, an early stage focused B2B venture fund called Storm Ventures, where I've been for almost 5 years. And prior to being here on the venture side, I actually ran a nonprofit for a number of years that operated at Stanford, believe it or not, to support student entrepreneurs on campus and students generally who were just interested in getting a hands-on business experience.
Yeah.
Got to do that. And that's in many ways what sort of gave me more exposure to tech startups and put me on a path to end up in the whole venture landscape personally.
Is that Stanford Student Enterprises?
That's right. Yeah. It's actually funny because Stanford Student Enterprises has been around for many, many years. Actually, it predates California as nonprofit laws even. So it's almost as old as the university. Largely because it's the business side of the student government. So it's there to ensure the longevity of the independence of student government and campus. So our job is to make money, to make sure student life constantly has representation.
Yeah. You have had a meteoric rise at Storm Ventures. Started as analyst, you moved up to associate, senior associate, and now you're principal. Can you tell me about that journey and also tell us about Storm Ventures itself and what your current focus is?
It's been one heck of a ride, to say the least. Look, you know, for me, it's been a journey of just growing. You know, when I came into venture, you know, as I mentioned, I was coming from this unique background where I had this operating experience running a nonprofit that was touching the tech ecosystem with the incubators and accelerator programs we ran. Coming in, it was a lot of sort of just absorbing information left and right, understanding venture capital as an industry, how Storm Ventures operate within that ecosystem. And then once I started to kind of get that experience under my belt, I was able to start to utilize it to move upwards, to begin providing more and more value to the firm. And because I was providing, you know, sufficient value to the firm, so companies were investing in and bringing in great deals, you know, my partners felt like it made sense consistently to promote me and move me upwards. And so, as you put it, meteoric is one way of putting it. I think of it more around just, you know, hard work and putting one foot in front of the other. But, you know, yeah. I also have to give it to the partners, right? You know, Storm is led by Tehi Nam and Ryan Floyd, who both founded the firm, along with a few other gentlemen. And, you know, they've been sort of, you know, consistently adamant about investing in people that are growing and able to provide value to the firm itself. And so they've invested in me. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're looking to invest in early stage B2B startups that, you know, are looking or have found what we call go-to-market fits. And so what that really means at the end of the day is that they have found product market fit, and they're now in this phase of the company where they're looking to build out a process that allows them to scalably and efficiently add new customers to the business. And we like to come in and invest when companies have about $1 million of revenue and then help them scale that revenue over time and prepare them for the next round of financing. And so that's generally where we like to play. And the firm's been doing this across 6 funds for over 20 years, believe it or not. So it's, you know, we're not the new kids in the block anymore, even if I'm one of the newer kids in the block.
Yeah. Having worked in B2B for most of my career, I think it's a fascinating area that often gets overlooked as a cool area, but a lot of cool things can happen there.
I couldn't agree more. You know, you're right that, you know, for a long time, and certainly when I was entering venture, you know, consumer investing was sort of maybe the more interesting space for a lot of people, particularly a lot of young people. But, you know, from my standpoint, Nick, I think the B2B space has such a broad aperture and impacts so many different industries uniquely. It's, I think, a very interesting space. And our job is to find inefficiencies out there and how, and understand how technology can help make those efficient inefficiencies more efficient, help people do more and empower them, and ultimately to solve big problems. And I think, you know, we're seeing COVID right now arguably creating this unique environment where you're accelerating the digital transformation in almost every business.
Yeah.
And it's been very interesting to be front and center, kind of, in the passenger seat, as so many of our portfolio companies have been sort of, you know, trying to utilize this period to continue to grow their businesses and accelerate and help their customers be successful as they adopt to a new working environment.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. How's your pandemic been going?
How's anyone's pandemic been going? It's been one, call it big question, or fire put out by another fire, followed by another one. And unfortunately, I mean that both quite literally here in California with the wildfires we've been having.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, it's been a dynamic period, you know, whether that was the start of this period with all the confusion that I think, you know, PPP created, and whether it made sense for tech companies or not, or startups and small businesses, how to navigate that environment, to replanning and thinking about, you know, what is the demand going to look like for different products as, you know, COVID and people work from home impact businesses outside of just the hospitality and travel spaces. And so I'd say, look, it's been a period where we're asking a lot of questions with the sand, but need our feet is shifting constantly. And we're just trying to, you know, not freak out, but be patient, but also be, you know, purposeful and make sure we have solid plans for how to react quickly. Because in periods like this, it's going to be about the speed by which you can react to the environment. But doesn't mean you pull that trigger, you know, without having a clear understanding of what should cause that trigger to get pulled.
Yeah. So what's the state of investing today? We're 6 months, 7 months, whatever it is, into the pandemic, and there's been so much unrest. What's the state of investing right now?
Yeah, you know, investors, we're out here. We're still investing. It's funny, you know, like even with all the macroeconomic questions that are happening with, you know, in the United States here, you know, the early stage ecosystem, we're still actively looking for deals. We're actively investing in companies. I wouldn't say that the pace has shifted all that much. I think there's a more concerted focus increasingly on cash efficiency and how you utilize money. And so call it burning money for, you know, growth and low costs is certainly evolving and shifting. But, you know, that's been something that a lot of investors, you know, have been thinking and wanting to see happen for a long time anyways. I think what is unique right now is that we're in this period where valuations of private companies have still started to creep up. You know, and the multiples investors are paying are quite high. And I think right now, that's largely because you have a lot of large funds, a lot of funds, period, going after the same sets of deals increasingly. Because, you know, if you have a great looking business right now, you know, a lot of people want to put their money or park it in great businesses. And that was always true, but it's probably even more true right now with the uncertainty happening. And so if you've got a good performing business, I mean, it's a great market to be fundraising in, weirdly.
Yeah. I want to ask about your process and how have you started any deals and closed any deals during the pandemic without meeting anybody in person?
Yeah, at the firm, we absolutely have. And, you know, we were lucky that we had done that once prior, before COVID, a few years ago in an Atlanta-based company. So we at least internally had some, call it muscle memory on how to navigate that process. And granted, that was a unique situation where we just had a time clock where we really couldn't, you know, fast enough to, you know, we had the time to go meet those founders in person. But, you know, since COVID, has sort of become, you know, like the key part of the business environment. You know, we've invested in three companies, two of whom we have not met the founders in person yet. I have, to be frank, not met them even at this point yet. And so we've had to adjust. Yeah. And our process is just right now focused a little heavier than it may have previously focused on references, right? And how we backdoor the founders that we're, you know, evaluating, backing, you know, millions of dollars. And so, you know, it's just, I think, an increased effort on that, while also an increased sort of deep dive in how our business, you know, can be cash efficient should they need to be and still have a positive outcome for all stakeholders.
So you're a founder of Black VC, which I really want to dig into. Can you tell me about what led to the founding, how you've evolved the operation, and what you're up to these days?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, and I'm glad we're spending some time on this topic. You know, so Black VC, you know, was originally an organization that, you know, call it 3.5 years ago, Sydney Sykes and myself co-founded largely on the back of having a number of conversations between one another, but also with other young Black investors, where we were all sort of at this inflection point. You know, many of us have been in venture for about a year, year and a half, and we were starting to ask this question of how do we chart the long-term path in this industry? You know, venture is a really unique industry as compared to a lot of other industries because it relies so heavily on a mentorship model between sort of partners and junior investing professionals.
Right.
And it's a cottage industry. So many funds do things very differently from one another. And what we were trying to figure out is, okay, what are the things we're missing, right? Like, what am I not learning that might be key to, say, NEA's model of investing versus Storm Ventures' models of investing or General Catalyst's form and how they think about deals? And so, you know, all these questions kind of culminated into a number of us asking this question of like, well, why isn't there an organization or group that's formed that exists to just allow the community to get to know one another, but also to share this information in a grassroots sort of way? And, you know, we had some conversations with some of the Black general partners out in the community that had been successful themselves to just kind of understand why there wasn't a group that existed. And ultimately, we kept hearing the same thing, which is that there just weren't enough investors that were on the scene for there to be a critical mass where an organization whose goal was to sort of build that connectivity, build that knowledge and that mentorship sort of in the ecosystem just didn't quite make sense. But many folks have noticed that Sydney and I uniquely kind of, I think, saw at the time was that the number of junior Black people had suddenly grown significantly. And I think largely because Sydney was coming from Harvard, I was coming from Stanford, we both uniquely had access to those networks. And so we saw many of our friends emerging into venture either right before we came onto the scene or as we were coming on or and the year sort of right after us. And so, you know, we were really easily able to sort of connect the dots in the junior bench and then showcase to those older folks that were around because there was a need, something had changed, that you suddenly had clients. And so you fast forward a few years from that early spring, you know, we continue to take that effort and that idea and that sort of insight and build on it.
Hey, Frederick, so with the rise of this essentially vocational networking organization that Black VC is and all the wonderful work it's doing, has that started to move the needle on the number of Black, brown, and female founders that are actually getting VC money?
Yeah, no, so I really appreciate that question. And it's something, you know, we think about it a lot here at Black VC. it's actually a project we're actually currently focused on, right? Trying to answer that and better understand the impact that we're having in the broader ecosystem. So while I don't have data to answer that, anecdotally, you know, one of the things I'll point to is, you know, one of our clear focus areas is around creating, you know, and uplifting and promoting Black individuals in the venture ecosystem so that they were in positions where they can write checks or make decisions on which companies get invested. And obviously, I mean, for us, you know, this is a really high point of leverage because at the end of the day, you know, there are two main problems, I think, that are impacting founder communities, particularly Black founder communities, and that's lack of access from a network standpoint into venture funds themselves explicitly, and then a lack of access to friends and family around money. And we'll come back to that second piece here in a moment. But, you know, that first one is really non-trivial because venture is fundamentally a network-driven industry where getting a warm introduction into a firm or to an investor is really everything. And unfortunately, if you don't have, you know, a diverse set of investors, it's really hard to ensure you have diverse access to a variety of talent. And so one of our focuses has been around how do we develop the Black community on the venture side to move and be in positions where they can utilize their influence or access to check writing abilities to invest in founders within their communities, but also founders that they're just excited about fundamentally. And what we have seen since Black VC has formed is that we've seen everybody who's been actively involved in the organization, actively involved in our events and coming, they've been getting promoted. And I think that's a key area, you know, that for us, we look at a lot because that promotion means that those individuals are one step closer to being able to be a key part of the solution to this problem around the network challenges. And so, you know, almost every Black principal in the United States is involved in Black VC, which is, you know, a testament to us trying to build the next generation of venture investors and networking them. But then, you know, the second point that I mentioned, right, the network versus the friends and family round, you know, one of the key things we try to do is advocate for the challenges the Black founders are experiencing and facing, right? We can't invest in all of them. And every founder out there, even though we'd like to, and iStorm, you know, I'm very sort of focused on a specific set of invest founders and businesses themselves. But what we can do is advocate for fundamental challenges that exist and that are unique to our community. And I think, you know, one of the big ones is friends and family round sort of foundation that the entire venture industry is predicated on. And for those listeners out there who aren't aware of what this is, it's this expectation that venture investors have that a founder is able to raise, you know, on average, close to $150,000 from their own personal network of people. And in the United States, where you know, exist in a community here where wealth isn't equally situated across all races and, quite frankly, genders even, that creates a real structural problem. And so one of the things we've been really trying to bring light to it is the fact that, you know, we need to do more to solve for those structural problems with structural solutions, right? We need to figure out how do we cater to Black founders when we know that the average Black household in the United States has 10 times less wealth accumulated than the average white household in the United States. And that fundamentally means that their ability to raise that friends and family is not the same as those that coming from a different background. And that means then the progress that those founders can make on those resources are somewhat limited. And so we need to find unique ways to solve what I perceive to be a structural problem in venture capital with a structural solution. And those are the kinds of conversations we try to have at Black VC to meaningfully support and promote Black founders and you know, the things they need to be able to be successful beyond just mentorship and guidance from a, you know, an experiential standpoint.
That's a great thoughtful answer. And I want to just sort of ping one piece of it, because there's something that you mentioned in passing that I'd be interested in exploding into a slightly larger discussion. You mentioned the lack of data in passing. And I'm curious on two fronts. Just speaking about the organization that you know best within the VC world, which would be Storm, I assume, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the relative lack of data about Black VC hiring, Black VC promotions, you know, that sort of thing that I think speaks more directly to Black.VC. But then the second part of what I'm really, really curious about is why there isn't more data about, you know, the number of Black, brown, and female founders that receive venture money. There's this landmark study that was done, I think, like in 2010, 2011. I'm pretty sure that predates your VC.
It does.
But I'm not sure. And it was Deloitte and someone else, and you know, they reported on it. And then, you know, the entire wave of wealth creation ensued from 2011 to 2019. And just recently, there's been discussion about it, and there's a group called Diversity VC and something called Rate My Investor, and they have a study out, and you know, they've done a pretty good job with their methodology, and you know, I don't know what it is, maybe 500 companies or something. It's not a huge number, but at least it's a disciplined methodology. But think about that, from 2010 to 2011 to 2017 or 18, when this diversity, there's such a paucity of data about this that is, it's like an invisible problem almost. And I'm curious, like, what parts of those two pieces Black VC has encountered, you know, what you're advocating for to address it?
Yeah, I mean, this data problem is a profound one. And it's one we spend a lot of time discussing. You know, it's actually one of the core areas where we are, you know, sort of as we kind of move into this new phase for us as an organization, as we've put a nonprofit around Black VC and starting to look to bring in some full-time staff to kind of take Black VC to its next natural progression. You know, one of the key areas for us is, you know, being sort of at the hub or at the center of a lot of the data that's being generated out there to help sort of provide the right yields so that we're asking the right questions and getting the right data sets themselves. And so it's absolutely something we need to think a lot about. You know, I think we can kind of parse this in a couple of ways. And so let's start maybe with the VC hiring side of things. You know, I think, unfortunately, you know, the reality is, you know, VCs tend to hire from a very limited pool of candidates in general. They often hire, for the most part, from Ivy League universities, including Stanford and Harvard, obviously, which currently represents sort of the biggest sort of segment from SAP itself in the industry. And so that creates, you know, a certain challenge. But the reality is, you know, you'll hear a lot of VCs talk about, you know, there's a pipeline problem, right? Like, we want to hire great diverse talent, but we can't find them, or they just aren't out there. And I think, you know, I look at that rather disingenuously.
Exactly.
I think that I don't think that's accurate, at least no longer. You know, the reality is a lot of these universities have been churning out great diverse talent for a long time. And so I don't think that's sufficient. And I think, quite frankly, we also see that a lot of venture firms hire outside of those universities, but they just don't hire diversity outside of those universities. Because again, you know, so much of the hiring is done within network. It's folks who people know, who can make an introduction in, or who have access to, you know, the knowledge of which recruiting firms and headhunters actually work with venture capitalists versus in it. And so it ultimately comes back actually to a similar problem that the founders have that are in the Black community, which is just networking and gaining access to these individuals. Now, we are focused on that in two ways. One is focusing on helping junior people become analyst associates. So we brought a program called Breaking Into Venture. What we sort of put on a, you know, silver platter, you know, up to a dozen candidates who are all actively looking to break in. We run them through a 7-week program to kind of give them the ins and outs on how to like manage a venture process of breaking in. We bring in speakers, we introduce them, you know, the recruiters that exist out here in the ecosystem. And that's for us actively saying, hey, look, if you guys think there's a pipeline problem, we'll show you there isn't. And let's have then a conversation about the unconscious bias that's still preventing these candidates from. But we get it. You don't want to have that latter conversation until we've sort of, you know, proven that there is no pipeline problem intrinsically. And so, you know, that's how we sort of approached it on the junior bench. And then we're beginning to ask this question of like, how do we manage the lateral transition into partnerships themselves, right? We see that founders often make inroads in, or folks who led growth teams or product teams at large, you know, fast-paced, high-growth startups make their way into venture. But we haven't seen that work within the Black community, even though there are plenty of individuals that meet those qualifications and criteria. And so we're beginning to explore, you know, with a few partners, what, you know, a structured program could look like for that problem. And not to you know, let something out of the hat that we haven't announced yet, but we're pretty close to announcing, you know, a program that we think will help solve for that problem explicitly and try to support the ecosystem. So that's in the hiring set. Now, with respect to the data and what firms can be doing, you know, I think it actually starts with, like, firms aren't counting this stuff. They're not generating data within their existing pipelines of founders they're meeting. And part of that is they may be scared to see the fact they met maybe, you know, only a handful of founders across certain segments. But it starts by saying, hey, look, every VC out there has a CRM where they track every deal they've met in a year. What we need to, as an industry, start to do is add a few extra layers of detail. And there's already, you know, lots of data points that go into those CRMs. But we need to include ethnicity, gender, where they went to school, stuff like that, so that we can, at an aggregate level on the founder, on the investor side, and at the firm level, understand in the last 12 months, how many founders did we meet that were Indian, Black, White, Asian, you name it, and understand where the gaps are, with data being the informing piece there. And then also understand, are there any like sort of gaps with respect to educational backgrounds or backgrounds that could include, like, are they second repeat founders? Are they first time founders? Do we have regional sort of focus for some reason, even though that may not be part of our mandate? And using that as a means to then I say, you know, what problem do we have? And then let's start to measure our progress against that data, because we'll do it continuously. So if our goal is to see more Black founders, because certainly you can't invest in a founder you've never met, then you can start to sort of proactively go after that and understand, are we doing better? And that doesn't exist at all at the investment team level. And I'd love to see that happen, because I think that will move things a lot further. And it's something we did here at Storm when I joined the team. My first summer, we brought in an intern to just do that kind of analysis on a team member basis. And it was really eye-opening. You know, folks didn't realize that, like, only one person was meeting founders across certain ethnic groups. And we were like, that's a problem. But we wouldn't have known that had we not done the work. And I think ultimately all funds need to start to do that work so that they can help, you know, obviously start to change the narrative a little.
Well, I really appreciate that insight into the Storm piece in particular, because, you know, that is a firewall that's hard to penetrate from the outside in, looking in. I'm curious whether that ends up becoming, or and practices like what you just described and processes like what you just described, ends up being among a list of best practices that VC funds adopt. I'm hopeful. I'm not overly optimistic in the short run, but I'm certainly hopeful over the longer run. Mark, back to you.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
Yeah, Frederick, this has been a fascinating discussion so far, and I've just got a couple more questions. I want to learn about the We Won't Wait event. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so, you know, right after, you know, the tragic murder of George Floyd, you know, we here at Black VC, so 32, broadly speaking, leaders across the organization, you know, we were sitting there and sort of reflecting in the tone that we were seeing from Twitter and social media, from our industry, right? Tech executives, venture capitalists. And what we realized was that it seemed like there was a disconnect. Everyone was pointing to how, you know, horrible this could be, and that something like this could happen in America. And unfortunately, within the Black community, it was sort of, you know, oh, well, welcome to the party. We've been talking about this. This has been part of our existence for since, you know, since we can think and we remember. But more importantly, what we realized is that there wasn't any sort of reflection yet around how do these same dynamics play out in our industry, in our field, in business, right? And granted, we're not talking about necessarily the brutal murder of an individual, but rather how race and ethnicity can impact both consciously and unconsciously your experience in the worlds of, you know, of tech here. And so, you know, we put this event together. You know, we had over 7,000 individuals engaged with us, both live and right after the event. And it was really an opportunity to share stories from peers, right? And how they've engaged or struggled with racism in this industry or in their lives. And, you know, I think for a lot, it was eye-opening. Because I think, you know, hearing someone you know, someone you respect, explaining how they've been, you know, treated poorly just because of the color of their skin or the unique challenges they experience or the thoughts and the doubts that they are constantly struggling with, it was a cathartic, I think, moment for our community and the Black community here, but also I think an eye-opening moment for venture capital firms and you know, founders alike. And it's really helped to generate and sustain this conversation. Okay, what can we be doing here? And so how do we start to think about the privilege we all have as technologists? And how do we utilize that knowledge and the privilege to help make the world a better place ultimately? And so the real goal there was to shine a mirror and a light into the venture ecosystem and tech around, you know, where our shortfalls, you know, our issues are with respect to, you know, how we treat Black persons here, and then also begin to have a conversation around, you know, what can we do moving forward? How do we support one another? And also be very clear about the fact that, like, it's, you know, 2020. It shouldn't be that 60 years after the Black community got the right to vote in this country, that we should still be struggling with fundamental issues around access and being treated and equal, you know, as equals, but more importantly, having an equal opportunity to be successful and to be bet on, which ultimately is what we're all about here in venture, betting on people so that we can, you know, drive great returns and ideally create a better future, whether that's socially, economically, or in any other way you might sort of define that.
I know that one of my clients is one of the largest companies in the world, and I know that they have, inside that company, have had many discussions about Black Lives Matter and the impact on it on their employees. And couple that with the kind of recognition that everyone's a human being that has families, and now that they're working at home, they have to kind of juggle all kinds of things. How does specifically Black Lives Matter being discussed in tech and in corporate America, how will that affect civil rights, do you think?
Yeah, no, so I think ultimately it's about an understanding and a transition from this notion of, hey, I'm not racist, and the individuality around racism and prejudices, right? And I don't think anybody here around the table at Black VC is explicitly trying to state that, you know, on the other side of the table is, you know, a card-carrying KKK member, so to speak, right, to go for the extreme. But that does not mean that there aren't sort of structures that have benefited people differently. And I don't know that we as a country have evaluated those structures and business fully. And that's really important because, you know, when you have such rampant wealth inequality, that means the thing is still not working in the system itself, right? That there isn't an ability to rectify or create a more prosperous future. And then ultimately, you know, where civil rights really never fully made a lot of gains was around this wealth question. It was around being able to generate or provide opportunities for the community to generate more wealth, whether that was through business creation, whether that was through higher income wages or higher or access to high paying jobs themselves. And I think ultimately, when I think about these conversations happening in corporate America, it's an evaluation around what are the structural impediments that still persist today, and how do we eradicate this?
Moving beyond not being racist as an individual, or, you know, as you know, and not creating racist policies, but instead stepping back and reflecting what are the systems and structures and policies that we might have that might be impacting races and groups differently themselves. And it's that reflection that causes or allows us to build or an understanding around what can we be doing to be anti-racist, to proactively break down barriers of entry. And part of that means acknowledging, you know, that, you know, people have different realistic backgrounds, experiences, and that we don't all start at the same spot in the race. Some people are starting further ahead than others, and we need to make sure that we're creating opportunities for people to catch up with one another ultimately so that they have equal access to prosperity. And I think this is what gets me excited. These types of discussions that will achieve that next phase, I think, of the broader civil rights arc, which is movement from not only equality under the law, but then equality in terms of the ability to be prosperous in this country and to be able to start a business and have as much of an opportunity to start that business as anyone else, assuming similar experience and backgrounds. And unfortunately, we don't live in a society yet where that is true. But I think we can achieve that. And that's the hope long term. And that's the kinds of stuff that, you know, ultimately Black VC is trying to promote and push forward.
Mm-hmm. The old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, I guess you have to have a boat to participate in that, right?
Absolutely. You got to have a boat. And let me tell you, there's a lot of people trying to build their boats right now, but we've got to, you know, give them the final pieces so they can actually, you know, get that boat shipped, you know, seaworthy ultimately. Yeah.
So what I love about Frederick's answer and Mark's question was about, you know, social movements being discussed in the corporate setting. And that seems like, you know, something that is yoked by force together, but it's really super intuitive and operates on a spectrum. There's a lot of research coming out of Harvard right now that basically talks about the difference between Frederick referred to the equality under law versus what they're calling equality of opportunity, right? And then there's a lot of discussion happening at the corporate board level, which, you know, over the last decade has been renovated somewhat to include more women and more folks of color, and that's a good thing. But at the board level, there's a lot of discussion right now about essentially the fiduciary responsibility of a corporation to stakeholders, not just to shareholders. And that argument about creating equal opportunity versus just, you know, equality under the law is starting to sort of take on this corporate fiduciary tone to it. That is one of the things that's happening in the country right now that makes me reasonably optimistic. Corporations are the building blocks of the economy, but also of capitalism. So if you're suggesting that the lack of equal prosperity or access to equal prosperity is an existential threat to capitalism, maybe then finally people are going to sit up and take notice on a larger, you know, more macro basis. That's sort of what I'm keeping my fingers crossed over. And I think it sounds like Frederick is too.
Absolutely. Garnett, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the only thing I would add to that is that I think in a country where our population is evolving and changing as well and becoming more diverse, the time is now, right? You know, you look at a lot of these surveys and stats out there that sort of indicate that, you know, over the next 30 to 40 years, this country becomes majority minority, majority brown. And you know, the question is, are our corporations set up to be successful and able to thrive in that environment and understand their stakeholders or their customers effectively as they're situated and set up today? And an increasingly global market that is also very diverse, you know, you got to believe that diversity itself or investing in that will help drive prosperity in the long run.
You're also segueing into Mark and my favorite section of the whole podcast. You know, we like to sort of pontificate and guess and invite our guests to guess about the future. Just a quick
sounds dangerous.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it's fun, and because we get such high quality guests like yourself, you know, we oftentimes they end up being very, very close to accurate, right? So, but quick commentary back on your 30 years out or 40 years out majority minority. Yeah, you're hitting on another excellent point. That's the demographic shift in this country. What I'm fond of calling the multicultural mainstream, right? When the world is brown and black, you know, predominantly, then our institutions, economic and corporate and otherwise, set up to actually deal with that? And the answer is currently not, but it seems like the discussion is moving in the right direction. 2045, you know, when the census is actually projected to be, you know, majority minority, it's a short period of time away. It's basically two VC fund vintages, right?
So that's right.
And that's going to be interesting. I'm curious whether you've seen any, you know, there are folks out there like Robert F. Smith talking about moving 2% of assets to banks, black-owned banks, and that's fucking awesome. That's a genius macro solution. Personally, I feel like it's only half the battle, because that speaks to things like home ownership, and it speaks to things like, you know, local small businesses. The other piece of it is moving corporate assets into VC, black-led or minority-led VC funds. And I'm curious whether we could wind up this podcast with any sort of high-level strokes of genius or flights of fancy or whatever you want to call it, the solutions that you have to this notion of being able to move more corporate assets into black-led VC funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, the reality right now is that there aren't a lot of black VC-led VC funds. There are a handful, but the vast majority have not been able to raise large sums of capital. And
that's right.
Raising capital as a black GP is anything but easy for all the same problems we've talked about already, right? Lack of access to the networks. You know, it's a family office ecosystem that often allows you to launch a fund. And that can be a fairly opaque ecosystem. And let's be clear, you know, it's not a very diverse ecosystem as well, right? And so there are a lot of barriers to that. I do get excited when I see corporations trying to lead across some of these areas. And I think part of this is actually more than just corporations leading here. And I think we'll continue to see them, you know, like Google Ventures and Alphabet have backed Lotoni with Plexo Capital and his model and continue to sort of focus there. And they've obviously been leaders within their own firms as well, hiring Black talent. And so, you know, natural extension for folks like them. But I think, you know, what I'm really optimistic about and hopeful about is that LPs, particularly on the public pension fund side, which, you know, is really, you know, endowments and public pension funds are really what drive the capital in this ecosystem more broadly. I hope that we'll start to have a more nuanced conversation about where that capital actually ultimately is coming from. And when it comes to public pension funds, I mean, these are, and pension funds broadly, I mean, these are, you know, your average Joes, right? And average Janes, you know, and they're as diverse as the United States is. And in a public pension funds, they're even disproportionately diverse a lot of times because government jobs have oftentimes been some of the first ecosystems that, you know, well-paying jobs were accessible for the Black community. And unfortunately, right now, we're in a dynamic where the retirement wealth, these communities, aren't being, you know, invested or stewarded by their own communities or members from their community. Yep. And that also means the dollars aren't being reinvested in those communities themselves. And I hope to see that we start to do more of that we start to add that lens and layer, because it might be that Frederick out there that lives in Toledo, Ohio, might want his retirement income being utilized to invest in Toledo, Ohio, in his community, which might very well be a Black community. And right now, you know, that's not happening. And if you were to sort of level this up a minute, you know, what this is really about is how do we ensure that the dollar takes multiple turns in the community before it exits the community. And every turn that it takes in the community is an opportunity to help support, empower, and enrich that community. And right now, you know, we live in an era where, you know, the dollar in the Black community exits that community almost immediately. And that's by design in many ways, right? I mean, Black individuals throughout America's history haven't been in positions of ownership. And so they haven't been in positions where they could unilaterally sort of, you know, be part of that value creation chain. And so that dollar has exited the community almost explicitly, whether that was through sharecropping, even before that, when they didn't even have access to the dollar via slavery. And that has continued to this day. And we need to find ways to, in creative ways, reinvest in those communities. And if you look at other immigrant communities, they do a really good job of ensuring that the dollar takes a couple turns before it exits and leaves. And I think really, I ask this question all the time, how do we achieve that? And how can tech and venture capital be a mechanism to help promote and facilitate that? Because we're a new asset class. We're the, you know, young kids on the block. And, you know, we're one of the asset classes that is impacting and will continue to impact the future of this economy in profoundly unique ways. And if we can't figure it out, that's a depressing world to live in, I think. But the good news is I think we can figure it out. And I think there's more willingness than ever to try to figure this out and drive those solutions. And we just need to think about things equitably across the board and how these systems themselves have direct, but sometimes also indirect consequences. And it's our job to be on top of that. And so, you know, that's what I think about when I think about sort of the limited partner ecosystem and how the money, you know, can more equitably flow to, you know, Black GPs. It's the reason that it needs to exist beyond it just being good and the right thing to do. It also has a real economic impact to those communities themselves.
So I want to already, I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I want to invite you for a second turn at this at some point in the near future and also leave a bug in your ear or a thought item about what we might discuss in the future. And it's a segue from your excellent commentary on Alphabet. Alphabet continues to astound me, like how ballsy they are on walking the talk, I guess would be the right way of looking at it, right? Unlike certain other mega corporations that begin with an A and stuff like that. You know, I'm just constantly amazed at Alphabet and what they've done. You mentioned Lotoni, and that's one example, but they just did something really unique that I think is going to end up being discussed a lot more over the next couple of years. They issued this $10 billion ESG or sustainability or green bond in common parlance. And, that's not new in and of itself. You know, it's been around for a few years and in Europe, it's very popular and this sort of thing. But Google did something with this version of it, which was wildly oversubscribed, which is interesting, at $10 billion, 2.25% coupon. But they set aside a certain amount of that $10 billion for social causes, not for climate, sustainability, environmental causes. And the bug I want to plant in your ear is, what happens when there's a world where every many corporations in the Fortune 500 are issuing these types of ESG bonds and using some of those proceeds for things like funding Black funders? And we'll leave it there at the moment. But what a wonderful conversation with Frederick Grossi of Black VC and Storm Ventures.
Well, thank you both for having me and for participating in what I believe has been, you know, just an incredibly dynamic conversation and just a fun one to have too. I mean, these are issues that, you know, obviously I think a lot about, but also, you know, issues that I'm hopeful a broader set of audience members can engage with, because I think it requires an informed and engaged group of people more broadly that will drive the change ultimately. Because I think when good people hear these things, good people want to drive change. And, you know, ultimately we're seeing that. And I think whether Black Lives Matter is able to achieve more equity for folks will depend on whether we as a community of peers are able to continue to uplift the voices out there and just have hard conversations. You know, these aren't fun for a lot of folks, but they're important to have. And so thank you both for utilizing your platform here to have this conversation.
And Frederick, you know, I know you've been getting the word out, because when we were planning these episodes for the next season over the summer, I turned on CNBC and there you were. And I said, I know that dude. We've got to have him on the podcast. And here you are.
That's right. Well, we're actively trying to get the word out there and actively also trying to, you know, advocate for our founders as well and support them in unique ways. You know, because again, you know, a lot of this work, you know, also impacts them, right? And so we definitely have a lot more work to do. But the folks over at CNBC have been phenomenal. And so it was just an absolute pleasure getting to participate with them. The one thing they don't tell you is that everything's aired on the East Coast time. And so while it looked like I was vibrant and awake, it was at 3 a.m. for me here on the West Coast. So it was a brutal wake-up call to be able to air on East Coast time before the markets opened.
Yeah, see, we work around your schedule.
Yeah, that's true. You did. You did, and I appreciated it.
Anyway, thanks so much, Frederick.
Thank you both. And please, you know, hopefully stay safe with COVID and everything out there. And look forward to listening to this when it hits the marketplaces, the podcast stores.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.